Welcome to this episode of Treating Together. Today we'll hear from Drs. Mark Bronstein and John Burke on the latest in treatment paradigms in CLL. Before we get started, you can find out more information from this episode on our site, targetedonc.com.
I am Mark Bronstein, and I am the Associate Professor of Medicine at NYU Perlmutter Cancer Center, NYU University of Long Island School of Medicine, and I treat patients with lymphoma and multiple myeloma. And I am joined by my co-host, John Burke. So he can go ahead and introduce yourself.
Thanks, Mark. I'm John Burke. I practice at Rocky Mountain Cancer Centers in the Denver, Colorado metro area, and I focus in my practice on lymphoma and multiple myeloma and CLL.
So this should be a good discussion. You know, it's been kind of a refinement year for lymphoma, where we have all these new therapies, bispecific CAR T-cell therapy, targeted therapies, and next generation BTK inhibitors. But I think there's still some debate on, you know, what the optimal sequence is in CLL. So maybe we should start the discussion about continuous versus fixed duration therapy, because, you know, when we see a new patient with CLL who needs treatment, I think this is one of the main considerations. So looking at the Sequoia study, which we had a recent update of the five-year follow-up of phase 3 study of zanubrutinib versus bendamustine and rituximab in patients with treatment in CLL or SLL, I think for young, fit patients, how do you decide, John, about whether you're going to give the patient, you know, a continuous covalent BTK inhibitor or maybe a time-defined therapy? Because there's that chance that they will relapse on the BTK inhibitor, and that breeds a certain degree of resistance. Do you think we've moved away from immunotherapy? How do you make that decision?
So it's a good question. And to even make the question more complicated, I think one could also now consider MRD-driven duration of therapy. So I kind of think of it as three different options now. You know, continuous BTK, fixed duration, which we've been doing both of those for years now. And now we have this MRD-driven option from the FLAIR trial that makes it even more challenging for me. So how do I decide? My answer is I really don't. It's sort of more the patient who decides more than me. I will tell you that pretty much all patients in my practice kind of hear about all of these options and are involved in a process of shared decision-making where we talk about the pros and cons of these different approaches, and usually they make the call. I will say that in my hands, most patients with treatment-naive CLL who are going to embark on therapy choose a fixed-duration option and not an indefinite BTK inhibitor option. So that's what my practice tends to be. But I do give folks the option of really doing both things. I think to direct the conversation to ASH, you know, in CLL17 trial, which directly compared those options with the three arms of the trial being ibrutinib until progression, fixed duration ibrutinib ven for a year, or fixed duration obin ven for a year. What that trial showed us at ASH was that the rate of progression-free survival at 3 years was the same in all groups, and the overall survival statistically at 3 years was the same in all groups, with a slight increase in infectious deaths in the Ven-O group due to COVID mostly. But really, it sort of confirmed to me that what we've been doing for a long time, which is giving patients all of these options because we weren't sure which is better, is still a reasonable thing to do, because there's not, to me, a clear winner. And so I take from the CLL17 study that we heard about that all three options are reasonable, and they all lead to good outcomes for most patients.
And that study, the CLL17, was published in the internal, and you know, with the primary outcome being non-inferiority between the three groups of venetoclax and atezolizumab, or venetoclax ibrutinib, or indefinite ibrutinib. It's interesting that, you know, you do have options, but I think that we clearly moved away from giving chemoimmunotherapy for patients when we have our options of targeted therapy, some of which could be time limited. And, you know, at ASH, we also saw the Bruin CLL-314 study that looked at pertubrutinib versus rituximab and bendamustine as first-line treatment, and that was also superior. So I think that for newly diagnosed patients, we can have a discussion about time-limited therapy versus indefinite BTK inhibitor, but I think those have become the standard of care options now, as opposed to using a chemoimmunotherapy option. Are there any patients in your practice where you're using chemoimmunotherapy for your, you know, typical CLL or SLL patients who don't have any, you know, signs of a transformation or anything like that?
Zero. I mean, I have not done that in years.
Right. And I think I would agree. But the other study that I think is worth mentioning was the Amplify study that was published this year that looked at also fixed duration combination of a BTK inhibitor with a BCL2 inhibitor with or without a monoclonal antibody against CD20. And it's interesting that we're now in a time where we can combine these agents more fixed duration and still get pretty substantial progression-free survival. But in several of these studies, including Amplify, they excluded patients where TP53 mutations, which, as we know, are a higher risk. So for these patients, not just the ones with the IgA, you know, unmutated status, which seems to be sensitive to you know, many of these BTK, BCL3 regimens, for the patient with TP53 mutation, do you approach those differently, or do you consider fixed duration or continuous therapy differently in that subset?
So I think I might have a different perspective than some. So I'll give you kind of a long-winded answer, maybe trying to touch on some of the trials you mentioned. I think, you know, in the last few years, the sort of expert opinion has been that because patients high risk defined by deletion 17p or TP53 mutation appear to have a longer progression-free survival with continuous BTK inhibition as compared with fixed duration, say, they should receive that therapy. And that's been kind of the expert opinion. And I think that's reasonable, although that logic does have the limitation that you kind of alluded to earlier, which is that, well, we don't really know that improves overall survival, which is what's most important to the patients. And when those patients do relapse from their BTK inhibitor, they have lost that line of therapy. Whereas if you treat somebody with venobin and they relapse at a relatively short interval of, say, 2 or 3 years, they might still be sensitive to venobin and you haven't yet lost that line of therapy, so the net overall survival could be the same. So prior to recently, I think my approach has been to offer, again, the same options we talked about to all patients, with the caveat that I kind of lean on them a little bit more steer them towards continuous BTK inhibitor therapy for the benefit, you know, for the purposes of that PFS. But I acknowledge that I don't really know that for sure is the, you know, the best treatment that's going to lead to the longest survival, and that it's very reasonable if they prefer to do a fixed duration. I certainly allow that. So that has been my practice, where I think, you know, and you alluded to Amplify with the doublet of acalabrutinib and venetoclax being, in theory, the winner there with less progression-free survival but better overall survival than the other two options of FCR and the triplet in that trial. So for me, you know, in interpretation of Amplify, the triplet makes me nervous. I realize that, you know, the PFS looks good, especially in the unmutated IGHV patients with the triplet. But because of the toxicities, which admittedly were largely COVID-related, so maybe that problem goes away. But I'm not totally sure of that. And so the, you know, added infectious risks with the triplet makes me nervous. So for me personally, I don't see incorporating those triplet regimens in my practice routinely, even for unmutated IGHV, which brings me to, well, what do we do for those higher risk IGHV mutation patients? And I think the FLAIR data are very strong, demonstrating not only improved progression-free survival with MRD-driven ibrutinib plus venetoclax, but a significant improvement in overall survival in the IGHV unmutated patients, with that MRD-driven doublet. So, boy, that is sure something I'm giving thought to. And, you know, they presented some interesting, not definitive data at ASH, but interesting data that, you know, going back, they sequenced everyone, even though they didn't allow the deletion 17p patients on the trial. But they found, you know, I think it was 11 or so patients that had TP53 mutations, which none of them had relapsed with the MRD during the duration, and they also had not developed BTK mutations. So unlike the patients treated on the other arm with the ibrutinib continuous who did develop BTK mutations, the doublets might be preventing development of BTK resistance mutations, perhaps by causing these deep remissions that don't allow such mutations to develop, at least to the level of clinical significance that we can detect. So I found the flare data to be really interesting at ASH this year, and it has me thinking seriously about using those oral BTK plus BCL2 inhibitor doublets arguably for a longer period of time than I have been doing until now.
You make a good point that, you know, I think, well, I don't check MRD on all my CLL patients, I think that it is becoming clearer that it's an important factor to consider, especially, I think, in patients with high-risk mutations, to have that discussion about whether it's kind of safe to discontinue therapy.
So that might be my sort of future strategy for those folks, especially as you asked about the TP53 aberrant patients. You know, maybe go longer term with the all oral doublet, maybe track that MRD. And I don't know that we know what to do once they achieve MRD negativity. Do you keep it going, you know, keep one of the drugs going, or do you stop both as they did with the other patients on the, you know, with all the patients on the FLAIR trial? I don't know. So that's an interesting question. And that algorithm was what Peter Hillman, the, you know, one of the FLAIR co-investigators or lead investigators kind of proposed for those folks.
So now we have our patient on a BTK inhibitor and they've progressed. Do you reach for a non-covalent BTK inhibitor like pirtobrutinib, or do you tend to switch mechanisms, or does it come down to, you know, certain comorbidities or patient-related factors or prior exposure or all of the above? Or what are some of your considerations for that next line of therapy?
And just to kind of link that question to the Bruin CLL321 trial, which, you know, took patients post BTK inhibitor and randomly assigned them to Perto versus control arm, which was idelalisib or bendamustine. And, you know, half the patients on that trial had received prior venetoclax and the other half had not. And Perto demonstrated activity in all the patients, and that has led to the recent full FDA approval of pirtobrutinib for second line and beyond. So I think, you know, when you have a patient who gets frontline BTK inhibitor, as you ask, and now is progressing, what do you do? You know, and your two obvious choices there are Perto, and it now has an approval for that based on CLL321, Ben or venetoclax rituximab combination. So this is a scenario that has less data, or, you know, we don't have a direct head-to-head trial here to answer that question. Not sure we ever will. So I think that's the scenario where I'm just going to discuss with my patients. I don't have a strong opinion that one way is better than another, and I think it's going to come down to kind of patient preference with, you know, theoretical pros and cons more than anything else. So that's kind of my take on it. I don't know about yours, but it's hard to be dogmatic about what to do with that patient.
Yeah, I mean, I think to your previous point about the time to find therapy, that does give you a gap between their first line therapy and the next line, and you may even be able to re-challenge patients if they've had a gap of a certain period of time, whether it's 1, 2 or more years. But someone directly progresses on it, I agree, it kind of comes down to the conversation. And I think also in the future, we'll probably be routinely checking BTK mutations and seeing if, you know, they have a mutation that's sensitive to a drug like pirtobrutinib.
Yeah.
So 2026 is here. John, tell us what you're looking forward to.
And I think in CLL, no, I think I know we're going to get more data on the MRD-driven doublet duration in TP53. The FLAIR investigators talked about how they added a cohort of those patients. So we're going to get more information on those folks. So that'll be interesting to see. I'm going to predict that they saw good things with that combination, but we'll see. You know, I have no insight as to the actual data. So that'll be interesting to kind of guide frontline therapy a little bit better for those folks. Other things in CLL that are of interest, of course, the degraders, BTK degraders, to my eye, look extremely effective in heavily pretreated patients with response rates in the 80s and 90% range and reasonable tolerability. Early days, but we know those are now moving into label-enabling trials. And so I don't know if they'll be available in 2026 commercially, but certainly 2027 or 8. Those should be on the market for CLL would be my prediction. And they look real good to me. So I think thinking longer term, you know, they may be good enough where we're moving them forward into earlier lines of therapy would be my guess. So I would say that's my highlight and the modality I would be most enthusiastic about here in the short term.
Yeah, I completely agree. I don't have very much to add other than maybe we'll be seeing more use of time-defined therapy in the first line and then having more options at our disposal in subsequent therapy and really prolonging duration of remission in patients, which is pretty remarkable.
Thanks for listening. New episodes of Treating Together drop the first and third Wednesdays of every month. In the meantime, you can keep up with the latest oncology news at targetedonc.com.